This week on the Best of Flashpoints, an update on the troubling case of the Scott sisters. Flashpoints marks the 3-year anniversary of the kidnapping and disappearance of Haitian human rights activist Levinsky Pierre Antoine, and an in-depth interview with the founding director of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement for Self-Determination on her presentation to the United Nations regarding the FBI's counterintelligence program. All that and more, stay tuned.
This first story goes down into the racist injustice file, perhaps one of the most troubling cases in the last 10 or 20 years. We've reported on it before. We're reporting on it again. There's some movement on the story. Jamie and Gladys Scott were definitely wrongfully convicted of armed robbery and received double life sentences each. No one was murdered or taken to the hospital during this so-called robbery. No one was even injured. The robbery, by the way, happened in a different car than where the Scots were. A witness says that possibly $11 was netted. A victim states that about $200 was in his wallet. Both victims and all witnesses say that the sisters, the Scott sisters, did not participate in this robbery. Witness confessed during the trial that the sheriff, Marvin Williams, coerced and threatened them into giving false testimony regarding the Scott sisters. That testimony was obviously not taken into consideration. These two sisters have now served 15 years behind bars. Meanwhile, Jamie Scott is currently suffering from kidney failure and is gravely ill due to the care she is receiving at Central Mississippi Correctional Facility. Joining us to talk about the case and the life and death situation regarding the health and kidney failure of Jamie Scott is Kambiz Mostafi. He's a spokesperson for the family. Sir, thanks for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now, could this be true? $11 robbery that they didn't even do. Nobody was hurt. Nobody went to the hospital. And yet, these women are serving two life sentences?
It's really a travesty of justice. The Scott sisters had run out of heating fuel, so they drove to go get more heating fuel. Their car broke down. They hitched a ride from two individuals they casually knew. After one of the two individuals began making passes at Jamie Scott, both sisters left the car and walked home. During the time they're walking home, another car with three young males robs the two victims, Duckworth and Haynes, and the Scott sisters are arrested for the crime. The Scott sisters were first arrested for conspiracy to commit armed robbery, and then it was upgraded to armed robbery.
Wow. And we understand, according to the information, that the sheriff, Marvin Williams, who apparently had some kind of vendetta against the Scott sisters' father, threatened witnesses into giving false testimony, and this actually came out in the trial?
Apparently, most of the individuals who had testified or had given testimony stated that they were coerced by the sheriff. The previous sheriff, Glenn Warren, had a vendetta of sorts against the father of the Scott sisters. When Marvin Williams came in, he attempted to receive bribe money from the father for a business he was involved in, and when the father did not pay, he took that vengeance out on the Scott sisters. And this is why this case is so important. It's not a race issue. Most of the individuals involved were African-American, including the police, including the sheriffs. This is really a travesty of justice issue, and this is really a human issue. And this is why we need to review this case. And it's very important because for all these years, Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood has been very quiet on the matter. Suddenly, he's assigned Charlie Rubisoff, an investigator in his office, to further investigate matters into this case. So he's waiting for more information for us.
So this Mr. Rubisoff has been assigned by the Attorney General Jim Hood to investigate this situation. Now, before we talk more about this case, what is the situation around Jamie Scott? She is really in medical trouble.
She is in gravely ill condition. She really needs she needs a pardon at this point. There is no other situation that could help her. Governor Haley Barbour is the only one who could affect that. We are attempting to put some pressure on Governor Haley Barbour. but we haven't received any answer back so far from his office.
I don't mean to belabor the racial side of this, but this is Mississippi, and black people are not known, have not been traditionally known to be given a fair shot, particularly if you look at the prisons, the way in which the prison systems, or the serial criminal injustice in many cases dealing with people of color. It is worrisome. But the bottom line now is we've got two sisters who served 15 years. Witnesses say they were threatened. Nobody died. Nobody even went to the hospital. And they've got two life sentences. And this woman, Jamie Scott, is destined to die in jail unless there is a serious response from people all over the country.
Absolutely. The jury deliberated for 36 minutes on this case.
36 minutes, and they got two life sentences.
The Scott sisters were convicted with zero physical evidence, no weapon, no smoking gun, nothing to implicate them.
There was a claim of a weapon, but they never found the gun.
There was no gun.
No gun.
They found
one,
yeah. Yeah. One of the main robbers, or the alleged robbers, Christopher Patrick, was put on the witness stand, and he testified to being coerced to give false testimony against the Scott sisters. The Scott sisters are really in need of a criminal attorney at this point who would like to donate some of their time to help them. So I would love to ask anyone who's listening if they could know a criminal attorney who would like to donate some of their time to help out the Scott sisters. That would be excellent.
So part of this crime is the violence of poverty in a society where there is clearly a difficult time for people who don't have the money to buy that net to net themselves from justice end up in this kind of situation. So poverty and the society's turning their back on poor people who need support could mean that one sister dies very quickly behind bars and the other spends the rest of her life behind bars.
Absolutely. And you already know what happened to Terrence, the son who snapped and reacted in a very negative manner, because it's a very, very difficult time for the family, very difficult time for the friends, the people who are around them, supporting them. And it's a very difficult time for human beings who care, because we see how can it be that a jury deliberates for 36 minutes, convicts both of them for double life sentences, one for each victim, but there's no smoking gun. There's nothing to implicate them.
Now, I believe that Terrence was interviewed by JR on the Block Report. I think you could probably check that out at theblockreport.com. And here, Terrence, who was very troubled, who obviously had had enough, could not stand the fact that his mother might very well spend the rest of her life in jail, and he is having some problems now. He's entangled with the law, so there's one more tragedy for this family who has been set up and facing extraordinary injustice. I want to let people know again that the news here is that the Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood, J-I-M-H-O-O-D, has assigned Charlie Rubinoff, Rubisoff, Charlie, Rubisoff. He's got an email, chrub@ago.state.ms.us. chrub@ago.state.ms.us. You can go to the flashpoints.net website. We will put it up there. We will put up the information, all the names, and maybe people listening to this show tonight, this broadcast, maybe attorneys, people care about a grave injustice and want to do something. Finally, after 15 years of time behind jail in a Mississippi prison, they can stand up, speak out for these sisters who were, in fact, wrongfully convicted. Any other quick advice before we have to say goodbye?
Please call Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood at 601-359-3680. And I'd like to thank all your listeners. Doctor, thank you very much.
Give us that number again slowly.
601 351-359-3680.
601-359-3680. And that's the Attorney General?
Yes, sir.
All right. Sorry. Thank you for your time. We're going to watch this case very closely.
Thank you very much, sir.
And it's a flame from the blaze, get higher and higher. They say, don't drink the water. We need it for the fire. New York is drinking it.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica. Good afternoon. This is Kevin Pina. Today marks the third anniversary of the kidnapping and disappearance of human rights activist Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine in Haiti. Lovinsky had just met with an international delegation when he was apparently taken from his car that was found abandoned the next morning on a major thoroughfare of the capital of Port-au-Prince. The police were given promising leads to find Lovinsky, but never really pursued them. The United Nations went so far as to try and cover it up. That's right, cover it up by omitting any reference to it in their 2007 report from the Working Group on Enforced and Involuntary Disappearances, or WGEID. That's right, the WGEID said there were no disappearances in 2007 in Haiti. Joining us now on the phone is Brian Kincannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti in Washington, D.C. We're also joined right now by Robert Roth of the Haiti Action Committee. And later on in the program, we're going to be joined by Wadner Pierre and Ansel Herz, both independent journalists on the ground in Haiti. Let's start with you, Robert. Robert, you were among the last people to see Mr. Lovinsky, Pierre-Antoine, before he was kidnapped and disappeared. Tell us a little bit about that experience, Robert.
Well, first of all, thank you, Kevin, for doing this program. I think it's very important that in a case of a disappearance of a human rights activist, that we do not forget the person and that we do not let the event happen without continual reminding people about the life and the work of Lovinsky, and also about the need for accountability around any case of political disappearance, which this is. And I was in Haiti in the summer of 2000, and really about, like, we spent on our delegation, we spent a great deal of time with Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine, and he traveled with us to most of our meetings, and we participated with him and with his organization, the Tronsetom Foundation, September 30th Foundation, a human rights organization. We participated with that organization in a demonstration in front of United Nations headquarters in Haiti on the 92nd anniversary of the U.S. occupation of Haiti in 1915. And so we got to see a breadth of the work that Lovinsky was doing in Haiti, and at the demonstration, he spoke eloquently about demanding that the Preval government release political prisoners, demanding an end to the UN occupation of Haiti, and also demanding the return of President Aristide to Haiti. And I remember the visual of it, of us lined up with, you know, a whole group of, you know, maybe, it wasn't a big demonstration, maybe 60 to 70 people in front of the UN headquarters with a line of UN soldiers, military, police, all of them taking pictures focused on Lovinsky, who was in the front of the crowd speaking with a bullhorn directly in front of them, and with them coming right up to him and, you know, taking the photos and writing down, you know, names and coming up to people and taking other photos. So it was a very intense situation. And then when I came back home, about 10 days later, we heard the news that he had been kidnapped. And, you know, it was both shocking, but also, to me, reflected the political situation in Haiti.
That is the voice of Robert Roth. Robert is a member of the Haiti Action Committee. He's also on the board of directors of the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. He was just explaining to us his experiences with Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine, one of Haiti's most prominent human rights activist who has disappeared 3 years ago, August the 12th, 2007. Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, welcome to Flashpoints again.
Good to be with you, Kevin, and I'll second Robert's gratitude for you covering this issue.
Well, thank you so much, Brian, but we know that, you know, I think better than most, that the police in Haiti were given very solid leads to follow up on this case after Levinsky was kidnapped, and we didn't know where he was. What happened with that case? Did the ball just simply get dropped? Was there a lack of political will? Why was no progress, has no progress been made in this case?
I think just as Robert said, that the kidnapping itself was a reflection of Haiti's political climate at that time. I think the lack of any effective investigation is a measure of Haiti's political climate since that time. The reason the case has not moved forward at all, a couple people were arrested because they were found with Levinsky's cell phone, but there's been no arrest of anybody even allegedly involved in the abduction, and no real attempt to do so. As you mentioned, the Haitian police were given a lot of leads, and that they did not follow up. Very simple, they were given names of witnesses, addresses, people who are easy to contact, and those were not followed up. Obviously, there's some things about an investigation like this are going to be difficult, but the fact that the police never did any of the easy things really doubts the sincerity of their effort to investigate. And that was also reflected in the United Nations as well. There were 8,000, still are 8,000 UN troops and police there, and they did not effectively investigate either. So there really was a fairly broad consensus among the people with power in Haiti that Levinsky's disappearance did not need to be investigated.
Now, you know, you heard me call it a cover-up because, I mean, how else can, I can't possibly explain, there's no imagination possible to explain why the Working Group on Enforced and Involuntary Disappearances of the United Nations would omit the fact that Levinsky Pierre-Antoine, one of Haiti's most prominent human rights activists, was kidnapped in 2007. How do we explain that, Brian?
Well, you can't by anything other than at least willed indifference. And Levinsky, for years, had been Haiti's most prominent grassroots human rights activist. He had a high profile in Haiti. He had a high profile in the United States. But not only that, he was a senatorial candidate. And Kevin, you've covered Haiti for a long time, and you remember back in the late 1990s when anybody who was either a human rights activist or a politician, as long as they were opposed to the Loi de Lost Party, if anything happened to them, there'd be a huge outcry and a huge investigation. I remember a couple of cases where guys went off with their mistresses for a weekend, and because they didn't show up somewhere Saturday morning, an alarm bell was rung, and there were all these investigations, and it was a real big deal. And the fact that shows that the UN, the U.S., that people can make a lot of noise about disappearances in Haiti when it fits their political interest. And the fact that they did not help the investigation of Levinsky shows that it did not help their political interest, and that therefore they did not feel that it was a good idea to pursue this crime.
Well, it's just amazing to me that we can be this far into the game 3 years after his abduction and kidnapping, and so little new evidence has been brought to bear. Let's go to Ansel Hurz. Ansel is also joining us, an independent journalist who's based in Port-au-Prince. Ansel, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks.
Great, Ansel. Listen, you were there today. I understand that there was a sit-in in front of Haiti's National Palace on behalf of Mr. Levinsky, Pierre-Antoine. Can you tell us a little bit about that today?
Yeah, that's not exactly right. The sit-in actually in front of the National Palace today was an action on the part of different organizations and leaders of camps of internally displaced people. They were protesting forced evictions. But a march in favor of Levinsky calling attention to his disappearance kind of intersected with that sit-in. It came up from farther downtown and basically met up with the sit-in in front of the National Palace and then continued on through Shenmue, which is the public plaza around the National Palace. And so it was just kind of interesting to see, you know, two demonstrations around issues that have really been ignored or not covered at all, really, by the mainstream media intersecting kind of in the same place. And there was actually a good press presence from both the Haitian media and the foreign media right in front of the palace at the location they're sitting today.
So based on what you're hearing on the ground there, is the issue of Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine still in the minds of Haitians that you spoke with today? I mean, are they still thinking about this human rights activist who was abducted and disappeared 3 years ago?
Certainly the participants of the march were, I mean, they were wearing T-shirts that had his face on them, and they had a large banner which called specifically on Preval to investigate the disappearance of Lovinsky. I think that I interviewed a few activists who were part of that march, and they were just very angry with Preval for not doing anything to look into Lovinsky's disappearance, and much of their rhetoric was directed specifically at Preval for just not doing anything to try to find a human rights activist who'd been disappeared. And that's really the extent of what I heard from those folks who are marching today.
That is the voice of Ansel Hirz. Ansel Hirz is coming to us direct and live from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. We're discussing the three-year anniversary of the abduction and disappearance of human rights activists, Haitian human rights activist Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine in Haiti. Now joining us from Port-au-Prince is Wadner Pierre, an independent journalist. Wadner was close to Father Gerard Jean-Juste, worked very closely with him in Haiti before Father Jean-Juste died of complications in Miami last year. Wadner, why don't you give us a little bit of background insofar as the connection that we can draw as far as the lives and the work of Father Gerard Jean-Juste and that of Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine?
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's always my pleasure to be part of your guest and partner. So today, you know, is like 3 years since Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine, a provenant of human rights in Haiti, disappeared. Today is really a sad day for us here in Haiti, not only in Port-au-Prince, but only for people from that short system founded by Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine, but for the entire Haiti, because Lovinsky, as Father Jean-Juste, these people, our people know that. So these people, they fight. They fight for everybody. They fight for everybody can have a good, a better life. That's the key between Lovinsky and Father Jean-Juste. And today, Lovinsky could talk. He would say, brothers and sisters, let's get together to make sure all of the people, all of Asian people, from Port-au-Prince to Jeremy, from Jeremy to Cap Haitian, can come together to make Haiti a better place, including Sojourner Jean-Baptiste House from South Africa. This is the man we lost today. This is the man we are looking for, Lovinsky. Me, I have my own experience with Lovinsky. We work together, and they always were there. Let's go. Wadner, to be the voice for the voice today. And if nobody can get when Minister attacked Cité Soleil, Lovinsky was the first human rights activist to take part and a march to bring food, water to people in Cité Soleil, because Cité Soleil was a camp where only military can go. But Lovinsky broke this barrier by giving food, by bringing food to people in Cité Soleil.
That's right.
Now today,
let me explain real quickly so people understand. There were these armed military incursions by the United Nations that were going into Cité Soleil. There were unarmed civilians who were basically slaughtered, people who had no guns who were being slaughtered in that neighborhood. And it was basically a concentration camp, as Father Gerard Jean-Juste called it, blocked off at every major intersection by these huge cargo containers. And there were only two people who ever went in there who tried to break that blockade. One of them, of course, was Father Gerard Jean-Juste, and the second was Lovinsky Pierre-Antoine, correct?
Exactly. And this day, I was walking with Lovinsky. He was so proud to say, Wadner, I'm going to bring food, water, to my brothers and sisters in Cité Soleil. And then Lovinsky made it. We went to Cité Soleil together. And then we said to Minister, we're not killers. We're not gangsters. We are people. We fight for something. And in this same way, the whittling of John Beta Aristide, the will is of all of political prisoners. That was what Lovensky, that was the work Lovensky has done. And then this is the work people like Lovensky, Father Chagis, we today in Haiti will continue to follow this path. And then we're going. And this is what we say, as long as we shall live, these people, Lovensky, Father Jean-Jean, and all of them, Father Jean-Marie Vincent, we're going to follow them. And this is what they leave us. And Lovensky is still with us. Because today, particularly in this time, after January 12th, and this time, for the upcoming so-called election today, Lovensky will say, "No, it's not make sense."
That is the voice of Wadner Pierre, an independent journalist on the ground in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. I like what you said, Wadner. As long as we live, they live. As long as we live, Father Gerard Jean-Just lives. As long as we live, Lovensky Pierre-Antoine lives. As long as we live, Father Jean-Marie Vincent lives. Brian, I just want to turn back to you real quickly again. This idea of Préval and people today in this demonstration inside of the Capitol, basically condemning Préval and saying that he did very little in the investigation to find out exactly what happened to Lovensky Pierre-Antoine 3 years ago today. Would you say that that's correct? That's accurate?
I mean, of responsibility for the investigation obviously lies with the police. But President Préval did not make it his business to make sure the police did the work. And that in Haiti, you obviously need to let the police do their work, but in the past, and President Préval has done this, as has any other president who's wanted to make sure an investigation works, just as executives in the United States would do. You put pressure on the system, you make public announcements calling for justice, and you really make sure the system does its job if you want it to do the job. President Préval has chosen not to do that. And one of the things that's interesting and is a source of sadness to some of Lovensky's supporters in Haiti is that his organization, the September 30th Foundation, was actually founded in 1997 at the behest of President Préval. And President Préval, in his first term, when he actually was very successful in building the justice system and pursuing major cases, was a big supporter of Lovensky and his movement. Again, that had changed by 2006.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, Lovensky also considered President Préval among his close friends. And I think that President Préval at one point considered Lovensky among his advisors. So definitely sad. Ansel, I want to go back to you real quickly. I want to end this on a note of knowing what the conditions are again on the ground in Haiti for the more than 1.5 to 2 million people who've been left homeless since the earthquake. I got to tell you, I sent out tweets today over the networks about today's program, about background, about Lovensky Pierre-Antoine, and the NGOs were cold. These people, I got to tell you, their attitude seems to be that Haitian history began when they got there and they began their projects. But Ansel, why don't you give us just one quick update about what's going on the ground with those people now?
I'd just like to talk a little bit about the other demonstration that was there in front of the palace. This was a pretty, I think, unprecedented action since the earthquake of a number of grassroots organizations working very closely with leaders of camp committees from Cité Soleil, from Farfou, from other zones, and they basically all came together in front of the palace and made some very specific and, I think, well-grounded demands for the immediate construction of permanent or semi-permanent housing for these people. The chants were, you know, Amba, Puela, Amba, Tant, saying, you know, they're tired of living under tarps and tents. And the demand was basically for housing. And I think that's a message that the NGOs and the government need to hear, because, you know, 7-8 months after the earthquake, it's pretty ridiculous, I think, that we're going into hurricane season and you still have 1.6 million people under tarps and tents.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Ansel. Thank you so much. Ansel Hers, independent journalist on the ground in Haiti. I'm not only a journalist, I'm also a human being. I've got to say, Pierre-Antoine, we love you and we miss you terribly. This is Kevin Pina, Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
In Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Early in the morning of December 4th, 1969, Chicago police, in cooperation with the FBI, entered the residence where Fred Hampton was sleeping next to his pregnant partner and killed the young Black Panther and community leader. Over 40 years later, we haven't seen justice for Fred Hampton or many of the other people killed, arrested, or harassed unjustly by the FBI's counterintelligence program. A collective of 34 organizations and 53 individuals around the U.S. have recently taken the issue of domestic spying by our own government to the United Nations Human Rights Council. The document being presented outlines a history of abuses of power by the FBI and CIA, especially focusing on the Church Committee's findings in 1976 and the FBI's counterintelligence program. It goes on to give background on the situation of political prisoners in the United States, carefully documenting many political prisoners' direct targeting under COINTELPRO. The document goes on to offer a number of examples where countries have granted amnesty to political prisoners, and finally, acknowledging the U.S.'s history of ignoring United Nations when confronted with human rights abuses, the document lays out a list of recommendations to seek justice for political prisoners and victims of the FBI's counterintelligence program. Among endorsers of the document are the recently famed Reverend Jeremiah Wright, the Black Agenda Report, and a number of organizations supporting political prisoners. We are joined now by attorney Effia Nawangaza, the founding director of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement for Self-Determination, who is another one of the endorsers. Effia is speaking with us from Greenville, South Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Effia, maybe could we start out by just exploring some more background behind this document? What stands out most to you, and what was the process in creating it?
Well, first of all, I should point out to you and to your listeners that the document itself has 24 what are called cluster reports, two of which deal with the issue of state repression in the United States, the continued incarceration and the murder and failure to compensate the families of those who were murdered and incarcerated, often wrongly convicted, is the legacy of the United States' history of political repression, of which there is a very lengthy one, and its use of its criminal justice system to repress dissent. The Universal Periodic Review process is one in which all of the members of the United Nations are subject to peer review of its compliance, its satisfaction of its human rights obligations, either as specifically set out in the in what's called the framework of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other treaties and conventions that are either held, to which all members are held, and or which members have subscribed to and ratified. So the United States, in its effort to rebrand itself and to, I would use the term, woo the rest of the world to greater acceptance and tolerance of its ongoing Bush-like practices, it will be participating in the review process, and it will be participating in the process in the person of Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder, which is very significant in light of the fact that the United States walked out of the World Conference Against Racism that was held some years ago and the review process that was held last year. Its charm offensive, of course, included representatives to the Memorial Observances to Hiroshima and now the UPR process. So the U.S. Human Rights Network, and I urge people to go to the U.S. Human Rights Network, USHRnetwork.org website, to review the all 24 of the reports and to become more familiar with the network. The network has sponsored 24 cluster reports, which deal with issues from education, health care, to state oppression, repression, and political prisoners. Having issued a call for participation in its sponsorship, those of us who have been working on the issue of political prisoners for a number of years and the issue of state repression stepped up essentially and seized the opportunity to put the issue of political prisoners and state repression on the human rights agenda.
Thank you so much, Effie. And from what I understand, Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder are expected to appear before the UN Human Rights Council on November 5th this year in Geneva, Switzerland. And I wanted to read a little selection from the report that you're submitting to highlight what the Church Committee found. Your report says the Church Committee concluded that the FBI had, quote, conducted a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed squarely at preventing the exercise of First Amendment rights of free speech and association, on the theory that preventing the growth of dangerous groups and the propagation of dangerous ideas would protect the national security and deter violence. It went on to report that, quote, many of the techniques used would be intolerable in a democratic society, even if all the targets had been involved in violent activity. And one thing that you're saying now is, even with this congressional recommendation, the U.S. government has completely ignored that report for 40 years.
That's correct. And so we want to give visibility to the report. We want the U.S. government to give viability to the report. And we want the U.S. Constitution, which reportedly represent the basis of the U.S. claim for exceptionalism as human rights standard bearer for the world, to be vigorously applied. We further want the United States to adopt and ratify all major treaties and conventions without reservations. The United States consistently adopts treaties and conventions with all kinds of reservations that wind up being little more than a show and display of participation in the international legal community, when in reality it has gutted that actual participation and the basis on which it would otherwise be held to account, which the UPR, or Universal Periodic Review, helps us to be able to do. We're also asking that all U.S. political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles be released, that they're released immediately and unconditionally. That is, that all of their sentences would be commuted without condition. And we're looking at the commutation that Jimmy Carter did in the case of the Puerto Rican independence resistance, including Lolita Lebron, who we celebrate today. And I mentioned Marilyn Buck as well, although she, of course, was not a Puerto Rican independence fighter. She was a North American anti-imperialist who was victimized by COINTELPRO. So we're asking that everyone's sentence is commuted. We're also asking that the United States institute an executive review of all cases in order to determine what compensation the survivors of COINTELPRO are entitled to. We're asking that the United States adopt the necessary measures to prevent or ensure that COINTELPRO and its various mutations. And I think it's important that we acknowledge the fact that while we talk about COINTELPRO, the United States' history of repression, political repression, and I hesitated because it's not just that it's political, but economic repression is represented by suppression of the labor movement in
this
country and various other forms of human rights, that that has to stop, and that it's the effort to repress dissent has taken various forms. You know, we can go back even to the Palmer raids as a form of repression, a form of COINTELPRO with surveillance and infiltration and provocateurs and people being arrested, incarcerated, and even murdered. We call specifically for a new trial for Mamia Abu-Jamal and for Leonard Peltier. So while some of the demands are broad and general, there are specific demands that we're calling for and that we want friendly member states to raise with the United States so that it becomes a part, an element in the ongoing evaluation of the United States' compliance with its international human rights obligations.
And I wanted to mention, just for our listeners who don't know and are not familiar with this news, that part of the reason that you wanted to celebrate and mention the lives of Lolita LeBron and Marilyn Buck, the former political prisoners, is because they've both very recently passed away. And here on Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio, we definitely want to celebrate their lives and their standing up for justice. Effie, I want to take our conversation more into modern times. On page 7 of the report that you submitted, it says, and I'm reading from the report itself now, in concluding its review of COINTELPRO, the Church Committee wrote, quote, the American people need to be assured that never again will an agency of the government be permitted to conduct a secret war against those citizens it considers threats to the established order, unquote. And I read that because I want to bring up the other document that was submitted to the UN along with the one we first spoke about. This one is called Political Repression, Continuum of Domestic Repression. And that report documents more recent abuses which defy the Church Committee's recommendation that I read just now and earlier on in the program. Effie, can you talk a little more about the second document and some of the more recent abuses that have been going on?
In the companion document entitled, as you said, Continuum of Domestic Repression, really highlights the ongoing fact that the United States government has consistently been hostile to the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments. In fact, from its inception, many states refused to sign on to the U.S. Constitution until the Bill of Rights was passed. That practice and that concern is a legitimate one and continues to this day. I don't need to talk about police terror as a form of state repression and state terror. It seems that the Bay Area is ground zero for police terror at this point in time, and the rest of the country is heartened by the fact that people in the Bay Area have stood up and resisted the violence that is being rained on the community. We talk about the fact, most recently, the G20, where in Pennsylvania, Twitterers like folk in Iran were tweeting about where the police were for various reasons, and in one instance, for the purposes of making sure that the National Lawyers Guild monitors would know where to be in order to make their official observations, was arrested stormtrooper style with jackboots and helicopters and all, and charged with a violation of what was popularly called the HRAP brand Anti-Riot Act. So these young people who were in Pittsburgh from New York, twittering to the lawful National Lawyers Guild monitors and observers, were arrested and charged with the HRAP Brown Anti-Riot Act. Their computers were seized, their cell phones were seized, and they, of course, were arrested. they have since been released, I believe the charges dismissed on the theory that the government would have to provide more information than it was willing to disclose in order to prosecute them. So therefore, the government dismissed the charges against them. We see that a lot also, where the government is withholding information purportedly for national security reasons. And it's notable that the Obama administration has exceeded the Bush administration in that misconduct. So we have the United States recreating that secretly, beginning in the 2006-2007, and putting Muslims, Arabs, South Asians, especially in those units. We see people's attorney Len Stewart being prosecuted for having, under the government's reading, violated the rules that were put in place to contain communications by persons that have been consigned to these sensory deprivation chambers. So we see this process moving throughout the history of the United States. We see it necessary to call attention, the attention of the world, to the continued human rights violations of the United States and to stop the charm offensive that the Obama administration would attempt to perpetuate and that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and his Attorney General, Eric Holder, would attempt to sell to the rest of the world.
Effie, I want to thank you for coming on. Are there any last thoughts that you wanted to give us?
I would urge people to go to the U.S. Human Rights Network's website to familiarize themselves with the Universal Periodic Review process. We are calling on people to begin to prepare for November 5th, when the United States will be appearing before the Human Rights Council. We're asking people to go to embassies and consulates to lobby on behalf of the and call attention to the reports that are listed there and express support and solidarity, especially as it relates to political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, and in opposition to the continuing state repression. That if there are not is not an embassy or a lobby in a given community, that people go to the federal buildings and to speak out on behalf of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, and against state repression. We will be continuing this effort beyond November 5th. The examination occurs on November 5th. The report of the working group of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations will issue a report, and the council itself will adopt it thereafter. After the report is adopted by the council, then we will disseminate, we, meaning the U.S. Human Rights Network and other members of the human rights community, will disseminate it and do public and community education around it. And it's important that we hold the United States accountable, as well as asking the rest of the world to hold the United States accountable. So this is the beginning of another phase of where we're saying that we want the resources of this country, we want the priorities of this country, we want the government of this country to acknowledge and respect the human rights of the people in this country and the people throughout the world. That we embrace human rights as our next battle cry, and we demand the commutation of the sentences of all U.S. political prisoners.
And that is the voice of Effie Owangaza, the founding director of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement for Self-Determination. Effie, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I want to wish you the best of luck in November when the information is presented to Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder.
Thank you.
Even before BP was at the center of the country's worst environmental disaster, hemorrhaging crude oil into the Gulf, the global energy giant was investing hundreds of millions of dollars in alternative energy projects beyond petroleum. At least two of those major investments were planned for the state of California, and the increased scrutiny on BP post-Gulf Gusher is shedding new light on these plans. One is the controversial multi-million dollar deal between BP and the University of California, Berkeley, to develop new sources of energy. And the other is a clean coal power plant planned for 2012 outside of Bakersfield, California. The so-called clean coal plant is slated to get over $300 million from U.S. taxpayers. Included in that sum is $175 million of stimulus money, one of the largest stimulus grant awards for a private corporation. Will Evans is a reporter who dug into the BP power plant deal for California Watch, a project of the Center for Investigative Reporting.
The government, federal government, is giving hundreds of millions of dollars to a joint venture that involves the oil company BP to build a power plant in California. And the money is being paid out at the same time that you have the massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
The power plant is being built under a 50-50 joint partnership between BP and the multinational mining firm Rio Tinto, under the name Hydrogen Energy California. It will take coal and petroleum coke, a hard black byproduct of oil refining, and turn them into hydrogen fuel to generate electricity for California ratepayers. The clean part of this clean coal equation is that BP plans to capture 90% of the plant's carbon dioxide emissions. The American Recovery Act and Reinvestment Act of 2009 was promoted by the Obama administration to pump cash into the economy to preserve jobs at the height of the economic meltdown. Investigative reporter Will Evans looked into many of the stimulus grants and found that some members of the U.S. Senate, including coal state senator, the late Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, earmarked large parts of the stimulus to promote clean coal technology.
Most stimulus money is going from the federal government to states, and then the states dole it out. But there's some huge chunks of money that are just outright awards to for-profit companies. And of the big stimulus grants, awards to for-profit companies, many of them are these clean coal carbon capture plants. And so this is not unique in that sense. There are others around the country that are getting hundreds of millions of dollars.
The power plant will be built in Tupman, California, outside of Bakersfield. Tupman has less than 300 residents, and Evans reports that some of them are skeptical of the new project, while others hope it will provide them with jobs. There's also an organized resistance to the power plant from environmental activists who live in the area.
This is a region that has terrible air quality. It's notorious for its levels of pollution. It's one of the most polluted areas in the country, and they don't want anything new adding pollution to it.
The power plant still has some regulatory hurdles to overcome before it gets built. Evans reports that BP's Hydrogen Energy California has lobbied the California Energy Commission for approval. Evans also reports in his story for California Watch that the state energy commissioner, James Boyd, is married to the president of the Western States Petroleum Association, which lobbies on behalf of BP, as well as Chevron, ExxonMobil, Shell, Occidental Petroleum, and so on. Boyd told Evans that his wife's job does not represent a conflict of interest. BP's clean coal power plant is still in the planning stages, and while it's been promised over $300 million in federal money, a little more than half from the stimulus and the rest from the Department of Energy, only a small portion of that money has been paid out so far, according to Evans.
They've paid out about $14 million of the $308 that they've promised, and it's basically the government and the company signed an agreement that governs the payout of this money, and it, you know, gets paid out over time when they reach certain milestones in the project. So that will depend on how far they get, whether all the permitting and licensing and regulation, whether all that goes smoothly, and whether they are on time. And I don't know the exact details of that because actually the government is saying that their agreement with the company is confidential.
BP plans to sell the captured carbon dioxide gases from its clean coal plant to fellow oil giant Occidental Petroleum, which will in turn use that greenhouse gas to push oil up out of the ground in a nearby oil field. Investigative reporter Will Evans says pumping gases into the ground to force up otherwise inaccessible oil has been a proven technology for petroleum exploration in use for years, especially in Texas.
Usually they don't care what happens to the gas. If it goes down and then comes back up, it doesn't matter. What's new about these kinds of projects is that they need to keep the gas underground forever.
The Earth was not designed to be a dumping ground for the stuff we don't want.
Tyson Slocum is the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He says that there are a number of inherent geological features, including earthquakes, that make permanent storage of compressed industrial waste gas very problematic.
Who assumes liability for this compressed industrial waste gas for all eternity? Is it going to be BP? No. The public will end up assuming liability in the event that there's a catastrophic release of this compressed gas, or if the gas gets into groundwater drinking sources, or any other issue.
Not to mention that if the gas escapes from the ground and nobody gets hurt, it still ends up in the atmosphere and contributes to global warming. Evans says that this factor is a major regulatory hurdle that has yet to be fully addressed in the state of California. Public Citizens Tyson Slocum says that the enormous expense of clean coal makes it a bad investment for our future.
We are still years away from having resolution with trying to figure out whether or not these clean coal demonstration projects can work and become commercially viable. And in the meantime, that means a significant diversion of federal money away from those technologies that have already proven that they can work, namely solar, wind, geothermal, and investments in energy efficiency.
BP's plan to build a clean coal power plant in California with hundreds of millions of dollars in federal money has mostly flown under the radar so far. You can go to flashpoints.net for a link to Will Evans' California Watch article on the issues. But another one of British Petroleum's alternative energy investments has generated a lot more controversy. In 2007, BP and the University of California, Berkeley proudly announced their partnership in a $500 million deal to research and develop biofuels. Critics of the deal, like Berkeley's entomology professor Miguel Altieri, say that it's another step towards privatization of the public university. Altieri recently published an open letter in the university newspaper calling upon the school to disengage from the BP deal, especially in light of the disaster in the Gulf.
We should not be associated with a corporation that, first of all, I would say that 80% of the people in this country probably hate that corporation. Second, before they signed the agreement, that corporation already had 8,000 cases at the court level of environmental crimes and human rights crimes, and the record they have on treatment of indigenous people and so on in developing countries, in Africa, for example, is horrible. So, my question is, should we be involved with a corporation with such a record? And also, given the fact that now this huge event has happened, which in my opinion compromises the mission and the public nature and image of the University of California.
To hear more from Miguel Altieri and his critique of the $500 million deal between BP and the University of California, you can check out the show from August 11th up on the site flashpoints.net. I'm Eric Klein with Dennis Bernstein, Jesse Strauss, and Kevin Pina. Thanks for listening.